Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've reached an alarming record. The ice cap at the North Pole is smaller than we've ever known. By 2050, or even earlier, we're told, the Arctic ice cap could completely melt in summer, replaced by dark ocean, which absorbs more heat, speeding even more global warming and climate change. This hour on Point, the melting ice cap and what it means for the planet. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine a North Pole without ice? Are we coming to grips with how extreme the changes to our planet will be? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. While there is ice, people go and investigate. Here's a sled dogs on an expedition in April 2007, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. On the Arctic ice cap, while it's there, and sled dogs there. Here's the Odin. This is a Swedish ice-breaking ship that rides up onto ice floes in the Arctic, uses its weight to crack them. You'll hear the sound of ice meeting the Odin's bow, again, as long as there is ice there. With us now, from Boulder, Colorado, Walt Meyer, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, which has been measuring the Arctic sea ice cover since 1979. Walt Meyer, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And from Piscataway, New Jersey, David Robinson is here, climatologist and professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers University. David Robinson, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So describe to us just how dramatic this summer's Arctic ice cap melt has been, David.
Well, it's reached record lows for sea ice loss. Almost half of what we saw in terms of late season sea ice back between 1980 and 2000 has left. We had a record low in 2007, and people thought that might not be broken for quite a while. And here we are 5 years later, and Walt, who can fill you in on more details, has monitored this and found an even greater loss. So it's something I never thought I'd see in my professional career, and I think many climatologists and polar scientists would agree.
Walt Meyer, can you describe for us there from Boulder, and we hope to speak to one of your colleagues who's been up in the Arctic, but the annual ebb and flow of the ice cap, what does it look like broadly, and how are we seeing it change?
Well, we see a seasonal cycle through the year. It grows through the winter. It expands out, covers all the Arctic Ocean, and then out into like the Bering Sea off the coast of Alaska, down the coast of Greenland and Canada. And then when you hit the springtime in March, it starts to melt, and it tends to melt back within the Arctic Ocean. As a rough estimate, at its maximum, it's about twice the size of the lower 48 United States, and at its minimum, it's about the size of the United States. It normally loses about half of its size, but what we've seen is a downward trend in that aerial coverage in winter to a smaller degree, but most dramatically in summer. And as Dave said, we've lost about half of what we used to have in summer. So now we're down to about a third or a quarter of what the winter is, the winter extent is, and we're about half, we've lost about half the United States in terms of summer ice cover.
That's an incredible volume. And just to give a sense of what the chart looks like here, I mean, in 2007, we had this record tiny ice cap in the summer. It was 22% below the previous record of 05. Now here we are in 12, and it's a new record, and it's not just slightly below 2007, Walt. It's at least, I'm reading here, 18% smaller again.
Right, right. So we've lost, you know, a 22% drop and then an 18% drop within the last 6 years. As Dave said, you know, 2007 came as somewhat of a shock to us. You know, we didn't expect it to drop so much so quickly. And the thing with 2007 that explained it to some degree was that the conditions were fairly extreme. It was a very warm summer. We had winds that were favorable to ice loss. This year, we didn't have near as extreme conditions. It was, of course, warmer than normal, but it wasn't as warm as it was in 2007. The winds were not as persistently favorable for ice loss, and yet we still smashed the 2007 record. And the reason behind these records is not just that the extent's decreasing, but the ice is thinning, and thinning very dramatically. And that's something that's not as visible, but we can see that happening, and we're seeing the effects of that.
We'll talk about the global implications of this climate-wise, and maybe some global climate reasons that this is happening. Well, certainly. But what about just what it looks like up there, Walt? I know you look a lot at the satellite images. Many people do. It's shocking to many just how small it is this summer. And I guess it's just last week that it reached that maximum shrinkage for this season. You know, years ago, around the time you're talking about that it's fallen by half, in the mid-1970s, I was up there working in the summer on the north coast of Alaska. When I got up there, the ice was right up, and this was June, I guess. It was still right up on the shore. Mm-hmm. It went out very dramatically one night. But the next, for days, we would look out toward the North Pole, and from standing on land, you could see what looked like a wall of ice some distance out into the sea. Is that still visible in summertime from the Alaskan north coast, or is it just open water?
From the Alaska North Coast, and especially in recent years, it's just open water. It's retreated, like you said. It used to be, you know, just off the coast. Some years it might be a little bit farther than others. Some mm-hmm. years it might have been, you know, farther than you could see from the coastline. But now you'd have to sail, you know, upwards of hundreds of miles to get to the ice edge, and the ice is much more broken up. It's much more fragmented than it used to be. It used to be that it was more of a kind of a solid sheet of ice, and now it's even where there is a lot of ice, it seems to be broken up into smaller chunks or flows of ice that get more easily melted and more easily broken up, even when they're thicker. And so we're seeing not just the area decrease, but really kind of a fundamental change in the ice cover itself, in the characteristics of the ice.
David Robinson, why is this happening?
Well, we always first look as climatologists with our skeptical eyes towards natural fluctuations. And as Walt just said, from year to year, the ice has varied in extent as we've looked back through the satellite record these past several decades. But of late, there seems to be, we have to face the fact that what we're seeing is happening at a pace and to an extent that not only was never expected, but is happening very quickly. And to that, we have to look to overall impacts on the global climate, and that's where we factor in global warming and human impacts on the climate system. There is well-known amplification of climate circumstances in the polar regions. The North Pole is seen to be especially sensitive to change, amplifying it at a greater extent and a faster rate than seen elsewhere around the globe, in part because you have this reflective sea ice where the sun used to shine down on the poles 24 hours a day during mm-hmm. the Arctic summer, and a lot of that energy would be reflected back to space. Now it's being absorbed by the much more absorptive, lower reflectance of the water, and that's just heating up the environment at an incredibly rapid pace.
Well, I want to look at the implications of this, but again, to the reasons. I mean, does this go straightly, clearly, from a scientific point of view, into a man-made global warming narrative or not? Is this part of some longer-term weave of nature that is not about global warming? Or do you just look and say, there it is, we're melting our Arctic ice cap, David?
I frankly think it's the canary in the mine. Because we were going to look to the Arctic to see the changes first, we're seeing them so dramatically, we can't explain them by purely natural causes. I think we've got to look at human-made, man-induced global warming as being an underlying factor for this massive loss.
And what about the implications downstream? Does it speed or stabilize or change the pace of planet-wide of global warming?
Oh, I think you have to look planet-wide to not only what's happening in those locations, but the implications of what's happening in the polar regions elsewhere. Or it's a new playing field as we go into, say, the fall and winter season, not only in the Arctic, but in the middle latitudes. And even perhaps in the winter, as an event such as an El Nino event unfolds, which may be the case this winter, it's going to be interacting with influences from the Arctic that have never been quite seen in this way before. So we may see an amplification of the jet stream, a wavier pattern to the jet stream, a slower jet stream because in the fall it's not feeding off differences between as cold an Arctic and a warmer mid and lower latitudes. There's a variety of implications we could discuss.
More weather turmoil, and I think you've said, David, that all the models that you and others use are kind of out the window. The models have never included so much open water in the Arctic.
That's correct, at least not at the pace that it's occurring. There were a number of models that suggested by the middle part of this century we might have an ice-free Arctic during a portion of the summer, and now it seems as if the tipping point has been reached earlier, and whether it's in this decade or the next decade, we could see an occasional summer, I don't know if it will be every summer, with very limited ice in the Arctic.
Walt, I guess the same question to you. Did you ever expect in your lifetime, in your career, to see that?
Not certainly when I started my career back in the early 1990s. Global warming and climate change were certainly discussed, and they were certainly predicted that we're going to see this happening, and this is the result of it. This is what global warming looks like, and things are happening a lot faster than what we had expected, and so we're seeing changes happening that we expected, but much faster.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the smallest Arctic ice cap ever recorded. Arctic ice shrinking, melting this summer, far beyond what we have ever seen. Looking at how far it will go and what it means for the planet, this little sound of wind blowing on the Arctic ice cap, while it's there, behind us right now. Look at your picture of the Earth. Think about the picture in your mind. That white cap on top, never been smaller, to human knowledge, than it has been this summer, and smaller by a lot than the previous record just a short time ago. Here's the sound of somebody walking on the polar ice cap. That's cold. That's ice. But how long will it be there? We've been talking with David Robinson of Rutgers University and with Walt Meyer out of Boulder, Colorado, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. With us right now as well from Boulder, but just back from up on the Arctic sea, Julianne Struva joins us. She just returned from 2.5 weeks on an icebreaker in the Arctic, making hourly ice observations. Julianne, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Did you see the cap itself? Did you sail far enough to see it, or do you have to go too far? Did you just see open water?
Well, that was interesting. When we first reached the ice edge at about 82 degrees north, we had sailed between Svalbard and Franz Josef Land. There was a lot of ice when we first entered the ice pack, but then once we went in a little ways, there was vast expanses of open water. And this surprised me quite a bit because I had been looking at the satellite data, looking at where the ship's track was, and according to the satellite, we should have been in an area where there was substantially more sea ice than what I found. And for large parts of our cruise, we were probably in about 50% open water, 50% sea ice. And this was surprising to me, and we are actually... We're trying to find some really large ice floes that we could moor the ship to, and we weren't finding any. We went up to about a little bit above 83 degrees north, so about 360 nautical miles from the pole, couldn't find any large ice floes, and we ended up having to change our direction, go further west, just to try to find something we could anchor the ship to.
Did you ever see the cap itself, Julianne, or you didn't come close to it?
Well, I mean, we were definitely within the ice pack. But within that ice pack, there was a lot more open water than I expected to see.
In past years, you must have looked at the maps. At 83 north, would you have been in solid ice?
I would think we would have been in solid ice. Certainly in the past, we would have been. And, you know, I mean, a satellite is a great way to look at sort of large-scale changes in the ice, but there's a lot of fine features that you cannot sort of see with the satellite data. And so being actually out there on the icebreaker and seeing the ice for myself, realizing that even though the satellites were suggesting there was more ice than what I was seeing, we were also noticing that the ice is very thin, mostly first-year ice, not a whole lot of the old thick ice, where we were sailing. So this is a big change in the state of the Arctic, and that you're losing a lot of that thick old ice.
So there you were bobbing around in the Arctic, which would have been solid ice even in the summer. I'm not sure what year. Tell us more about the quality of the ice you saw. You say not, you're looking at first-year ice, not multi-year ice. What about snow cover? What about, I don't know, standing water on the surface, ice thickness? What about the character of what you saw in the ice that is there, Julian?
Well, so a lot of the ice was first-year ice, and some of it was, I did drill a few larger floes, and they tended to be around 2 meters thick, so we did find some sort of thicker first-year ice floes. But a lot of it was thinner than a meter, which is one of the reasons we weren't really getting off onto the ice very much. There was usually about a 10 to 20 centimeter sort of old snow layer on some of the ice. Some of it had melted all the way off, but there were some floes that still had an old, really granular snow layer on there. There was a lot of melt ponds, but they were, most of them were frozen over. There were some that were still open. One of the interesting things about where I was is I didn't see any freeze-up happening, and I was there right before the minimum happened. We actually got back to Svalbard once the minimum was announced, but at least when I was there, I did expect to start seeing a lot of new ice formation, and it wasn't happening yet. The temperatures were still pretty warm.
Trying to picture where you were, Julian. Svalbard, is that, what is that, Greenland? Canada? Is Russia?
Well, it's part of Norway.
Norway, okay. Oh, that's right, of course. Okay, so you were north of that.
I was north of that, So we basically entered between Svalbard and Franz Josef Land and then went as far north as we could. And, well, we could have gone further. We could have gone all the way to the pole, I believe, by the quality of the ice that we were encountering. But
excuse me, may I just ask, do you mean you could literally have sailed to the North Pole itself?
I believe we probably could have. And there was certainly talk while we were on the ship is why not just go all the way to the pole. The concern was that we might not have as much time. And, you know, we were trying to, again, one of the objectives was to find some large ice floes that we could actually do some work on. And we probably would have found some if we would have went further north. But they decided it would be quicker to try to go west and find some over there.
Walt Meyer there in Boulder, as you hear that, what are you thinking? I mean, we think of explorers with sled dogs famously, you know, heroically going to the North Pole, and it is over a lot of ice. Were those expeditions typically done, Walt, in the summer or winter back in the day?
Well, usually in kind of the springtime, like the April time frame, when it's the sun's up a little bit and it's getting warmer, but the ice hasn't started to melt because
dangerous.
And it wasn't because the ice was going to disappear during the summer. It was because it just would get a lot harder. The snow gets slushy. You start getting melt ponds. You might start getting some cracks in the ice, you know, ice that make it a lot harder. So earlier is better given the daylight. But now, as Julian said, it would almost be impossible to go up there with a sled dog. I think certainly during the summertime, you'd be better off going with a ship probably.
And you could find yourself in the drink in a hurry. Here's a little tape. This is oceanographer Tim Stanton talking with Andrew Rivkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times website. They're at a Russian-run base camp in the Arctic, and the ice they're standing on is starting to collide with another big ice floe.
You can feel this chunk that we're on actually starting to fail a bit more. Probably hairline cracks up the towards the helos there.
So does that mean we should back up?
Not yet. You can always jump over a crack.
You can always jump over a crack. Watch out. And people getting excited about what it will mean economically to be able to be up there without the ice, mining, and all the rest. Here's Artur Chilingroff, famous polar researcher, talking with the Canadian Broadcasting Company about the importance of the resources in the Arctic for Russia.
For us, the North Pole is a Soviet achievement like space flight. Gas, oil, nickel, diamonds, gold, well, everything. Everything that is possible today. And it is tied to Russia's economic interests.
David Robinson, again, we're trying to catch up with reality. The idea of sailing to the North Pole, has that been a possibility for a while, or is that another one of these head slappers to you?
It's a bit of a head slapper. There have been areas that have opened up, leads in the ice, they're called, and sometimes areas of open water within in the pack called polynyas. But to have a direct route to the North Pole and to be able to do it safely, I think Julian's ship was probably wise not to try it because, as she mentioned, this is the time of year when things begin to start refreezing, and the last thing you'd want to do is be frozen in up there. But these are head-slapping type of situations that we certainly didn't expect this rapidly.
So, Walt, at this point, or I'm not sure who's best to ask here, maybe David, but what are the latest projections about when And if the polar ice cap in the Arctic may disappear entirely in the summer, what, like next year, 2050, a century from now? What's the thinking, Walt?
Well, I think that it's certainly happening a lot faster than we expected. My colleague Julian led a study that's looked at what we've been seeing compared to the models, and things are moving a lot faster. But I would caution to jump to too many conclusions and make too much of an extrapolation. I don't think we're going to see it next year or even within the next few years, because there is a lot of natural variation that plays a role, and we may see a leveling off for a few years, maybe even several years. I don't see us recovering back to anything where we were in the 1980s. And I think we will reach largely ice-free. You know, there'll be a little bit of ice around, I think, but with, you know, enough ice-free that it will look blue on a map. Probably within 20 to 30 years is I think, a realistic estimate at this point, but with a fair amount of uncertainty and with a fair amount of variation as we head towards that point.
I mean, I guess I'm being facetious when I say next year, just to make the point that things have sped up. Things have happened already much more quickly than have been anticipated, if I'm not wrong, Walt.
Yeah, that's correct. The way I've phrased it is, you know, there have been some scientists that said, you know, that have said in the next 5 years we could lose the ice cover. Wow. During summertime. And if they had said that in a room 5 years ago, let's say 10 years ago, amongst a group of scientists, they would have been laughed out of the room. But now no one's laughing. I think it's not an impossibility. I think it's very unlikely, but it's not completely ridiculous.
Nobody's laughing. I mean, there's so much going on in the world. We really thought hard about talking about this today when there's so many political things going on and geopolitical things going on. But here we have the planet itself in a very fundamental characteristic that we're all accustomed to, changing at a speed that, as you say, 5 years ago, nobody would have expected. Let's bring our listeners in. Austin, Texas. Deepa is calling. Hi, Deepa. Thanks. You're on the air. Hello, Deepa. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Don. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, we don't. There is not much of a human inhabitation in Arctic, but what's happening with the animals? Polar bear, tundra, walrus, you name it.
Yeah, polar bear, walrus, and all the rest. Yeah, let us pick it up. Julian, I don't know if you saw any evidence of animal life up there. What can you tell us?
Well, actually, we were fortunate to see many, many bears, and that was really a nice treat to be able to see so many bears. You know, of course, I don't know, you know, what is normal for that time of year and that part of the Arctic, because I actually wasn't my first time on an icebreaker. But, I mean, obviously, it's hard to imagine that the polar bears could survive if the Arctic becomes ice-free, because they depend on the sea ice to hunt the seals, and the seals also depend on the sea ice as well. So it really changes the nature of the ability for these species to be able to survive if they don't have the ice, which is basically fundamental to their survival. Again, you know, as Walt mentioned, we do expect, even though most of the Arctic may become ice-free, we still expect probably some older ice, thicker ice, to remain north of Greenland and the Canadian archipelago. So it's possible that some species could survive in that region, but definitely one sort of in the Beaufort and the Chukchi Sea and the ones in the eastern Arctic, it would be hard to imagine they could survive without any sea ice in the summer.
David Robinson, I mean, ultimately, I guess we're all in this boat together, but Deepa's thinking about the polar bear and walrus and all the rest. We've seen photos, which I think are show walrus crowded onto very huge numbers, crowded onto small ice as this goes away. If it follows this arc toward ice absence in the summer, what would the implications be? Can these animals migrate anywhere, or they're done if that happens?
Well, there are certainly ecologic circumstances that are going to lead to demise of some species, be it in the middle latitudes where they may move north or go higher in elevation and then run out of elevation to survive. You know, part of the problem is it's been such an inaccessible region that it hasn't been very well studied. So we're out there looking at things now because we're having greater access to it than ever before. So it's difficult to put it in a long-term context. But clearly things are happening, and it's going to have major ramifications to the ecology of the region.
Let's get a call from Robert in Hartford, Connecticut. Robert, thanks. You're on the air.
This is a global issue, and I had heard that the ice cap was expanding in the southern hemisphere as it was shrinking in the northern. And as, I'd like that addressed. And the second question is, you mentioned the jet stream, but what about the halide conveyor? You can define that, and I'll listen off air.
Thank you, Robert. Let's go to the Antarctic first. If we're going bald on top, are we getting more ice in the south? Is it, Walt, what do you know?
Well, indeed we are to some degree. We're actually, you know, this time of year it's at the maximum for the Antarctic. And it is actually in our records a record high maximum, but it's a much smaller change than what we've seen in the Arctic. It's about, we're about a quarter of the distance above average in the Antarctic as we are below in the Arctic. It's four times different. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that the Antarctic is a very different environment. The Arctic is an ocean surrounded by land. The Antarctic is land surrounded by an ocean. And the ice cover is all completely open to the ocean. It can expand very easily with the winds and the currents, depending on those. And what we've seen is that the influence of the winds have helped to increase the Antarctic ice cover a small amount in winter. And another factor is that the ice in the Antarctic is all very thin. It almost all melts away during the summer. It always has. So the Arctic is kind of becoming the Antarctic in that sense. Instead of keeping much of its ice, it's starting to lose a lot of its ice.
So net, in terms of ice loss, you're suggesting we're still down a lot with the Arctic loss.
Yeah, we're down a lot. The Antarctic ice is much thinner than the Arctic on average as well. And so the change in total mass or total volume of the ice cover is minuscule compared to what's been happening in the Arctic.
And David, of course, it's not only about ice volume, as our caller suggests, asking about the halide conveyor. I think these are the flows within the Atlantic Ocean that we we have because of that cold. What's happening in that regard, if anything, David?
Right. What we're talking about is really a global conveyor belt in the Earth's oceans. Circulation, ocean currents at the surface, but also deep underneath the ocean surface. And this impacts climate, particularly in the North Atlantic, but elsewhere as well. And it's the cold, salty air that sinks and starts that conveyor belt going elsewhere around the world's oceans. And if we get enhanced melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which is fresh water, we have to remember that we're not changing sea level or much changing the salinity content of the ocean when we're melting sea ice. But if the warming in the Arctic promotes more fresh water melt, then we could put a cold but less saline, thus less dense layer on top of the ocean surface. And that would inhibit the sinking motion of the water, which could influence circulation in the North Atlantic and elsewhere in the world. And we're not seeing this plainly evident now, but there's evidence from paleoclimate times that this was a very disruptive force on the Earth's climate.
Wow. Julianne, what do you think? If your children or grandchildren get into this line of research, are they going to have ice to look at up there?
I doubt it. As Walt mentioned, I actually recently updated a study that compared the new models that will be used in the next IPCC report to the observations. And those models are all showing ice-free conditions happening much sooner than we saw in the last round of the climate models used in the 2007 IPCC report. The average sort of summer ice-free date is around 2045 in these models. But again, as we've been talking about, the rate of ice loss is happening a lot faster than many of these models can capture. So, you know, looking at an earlier time frame, 2030 to 2040, is probably really realistic at this point.
Well, it's hard to get our heads around, but you've just come back from staring at it in the Arctic, and we're grateful for your time today. Julianne Struve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the smallest Arctic ice cap ever recorded. Just last week, Arctic ice shrinking, melting this summer far beyond what we have ever seen and recorded before. We're looking at how far it will go, what it means for the planet. David Robinson is with us from Piscataway, New Jersey, and Rutgers University, climatologist there in the Department of Geography. Walt Meyer is with us from Boulder, Colorado, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. They've been measuring the Arctic sea ice cover since 1979. Our thanks to Julian Struve, who joined us for a few minutes. They're just back off an icebreaker in the Arctic, a lot more water than ice. Can you believe how extremely we are apparently changing the planet? What's your question on how this feeds back into climate change? Of course, there's the kids' question. Where's Santa going to live? What about the polar bears? And are we connecting what's going on with the planet to how we live, the decisions we make? Eric in Boca Raton, Florida. Eric, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad you're covering this topic, but you just beat me to it, aren't you?
what do you got?
I'm going to literally talk about the fact that what is it going to take for people to finally make that emotional connection about the importance of what's happening to our planet? Do we really need news headlines like what you just said? Santa's actually workshop has gone into the sea.
Underwater.
The carcasses are floating around.
Oh, yeah.
Where does it break through? I just came back from an IMAX movie just the other weekend, and we're watching all this stuff about this thing, and there's all these kids in there, and they don't get it yet.
Where do you think it breaks through, Eric? Where do you think it breaks through and people say, you know, holy cow, we got to do something right now big?
I was like thinking at one point you're going to start hearing stories about the crop failure of hops, because then maybe it actually affects beer prices, and then the average American says, holy cow, my beer's expensive because of global warming. Maybe then it'll actually hit home, but I don't know what it takes.
Little Mermaid playing in Santa's underwater workshop, I'm not sure either, but it's a good question, and we will come to it. I appreciate your call in Boca Raton, Eric. One more first, Paris Island, South Carolina, Matthew. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Okay.
I'm very interested in this topic, and I feel that the last caller, he is on point with, yes, we are doing things at an unprecedented rate to change the global scale of the way the society functions and everything. But what I really wanted to do is get an opinion from your scientists today, talking about how many times in the history of the Earth has something like this actually happened? Is this the first time, and is it actually being caused by us? I understand global warming and the things of this nature, but is it actually being caused by the carbon dioxide that human beings are producing, or has something like this happened in the past?
Matthew, we will pick it right up. I mean, a lot of people are talking about this online, at onpointradio.org and on Facebook and On Point Radio on Twitter, all kinds of comment about this. Walt, David, let me share a few of those. You know, John's listening to the skeptics, and he says, on Twitter, kind of sarcastically, let's not panic at polar ice loss, Alaskan salmon collapse, massive global flooding and scorched crops. Let's wait till the facts are in. Greg says the iced poles are the Earth's AC, air conditioning. We are in for a world of hell as the planet heats up. But outside the box writes to us, David. Walt says, look, I question when journalists, scientists, politicians, activists start claiming to know the degree to which human activity is responsible in relation to underlying natural cycles of warming and cooling. You can say we're contributing, but don't tell me, this listener writes, we are responsible. There simply isn't enough data going back far enough to make any conclusions. Walt, what do you say?
Well, I would say that, you know, as a scientist, I'm always a skeptic, and I'm always reluctant to jump to too broad of a conclusion. And I think most scientists are in the same boat as me. We're not ones that are easily convinced. And what has convinced us is the data that we have collected. You know, we need more data. I won't deny that. But, it's really incontrovertible now that we're seeing the globe warm, and that the only explanation, or you can't explain it without including human emissions of greenhouse gases. You can't get to the changes that we've seen, and that includes the sea ice. And, you know, has this happened before in the past? And that's not a mutually exclusive fact from, is this being human caused? There are a variety of things that cause climate change. Humans are one of those that happens to be playing a big role now. But we have seen big changes due to, say, orbital changes in the Earth, you know, causing the ice ages. We do see evidence of the Arctic being ice-free or nearly ice-free about 8 to 10,000 years ago. That was clearly due to natural variation. So natural variations can cause these changes, but we don't see those effects. We don't see those factors playing a role or a significant role in this recent change, especially the speed of the changes that we've seen. What we've seen as the major factor is the warming temperatures in the Arctic, which is a reflection of the warming global temperatures, which have been clearly linked to greenhouse gas emissions, at least as a major player.
David Robinson, give us some more context here. I mean, Matthew calls in from Paris Island and says, hey, look, hasn't this happened before? We're talking here about the smallest ever recorded, but our numbers are going back to 1980. That's a blip in time. But we get so many sort of scales of time and relative climate conditions working at once that things can get confusing. I mean, have we had a planet without a summer Arctic ice cap before? Do we know, David? And whether or not, I mean, if we have, were there humans living at that time? I mean, what does it say about what we might need to brace for if it comes again? Maybe it was, I don't know, was it just dinosaurs running around if we had it that way before?
Right. I think we're hiding in the past if we don't recognize that there's a human fingerprint all over what's happening right now. I was first a geologist by training, mm-hmm. so I've looked back even billions of years. The last several million years have actually been pretty unusual in Earth's history in that there have been what we call isolated poles with a lot of ice at both those poles. That's more the exception rather than the rule over Earth history. But looking back over the last several million years, we've been an icy planet, and even more so than we've seen in the last 10,000 years, multiple times, with ice sheets down to New York City and throughout much of Europe. So we've seen these all from natural fluctuations taking place over thousands of years. And when we talk about abrupt climate change in the past, it's over centuries or millennia. And now we're looking at something that's coming upon us in a matter of decades. And it's coming with a pattern. It's coming with the timing. It's coming with the magnitude that observations, models, and just plain old simple theory shows has an really implicates humans of playing a major role in this.
What's it likely to mean for humans? I mean, we can talk about billions or millions of years, but we don't live in those timescales. You know, we've built our culture and civilizations in a fairly moderate temperature zone. If we're pushing this towards something different, how different could it be? What are we likely to see emerge from this, David?
Yeah, and that's the point. We're incredibly vulnerable. We've seen sea levels change in the past by multiple meters, tens of feet. But just imagine the consequences of that occurring. And we're not saying that's going to occur anytime soon, but we could be talking about sea level rises of several feet by the end of this century. And given 7 billion people on Earth, how many people live near the shore, depend on it for transportation and livelihood, we're very sensitized to just these smaller changes in the climate system. I mean, goodness, there's a natural greenhouse effect that keeps the Earth a habitable planet upwards of 60 degrees Fahrenheit more than it would be without our natural greenhouse atmosphere. We're talking about changing temperatures 4, 6, 8 degrees Fahrenheit. And that may not seem like a lot, but when those impacts change rainfall patterns, when they change sea levels to on the order of several feet, and, of course, when they melt the Arctic ice cap, we're talking about profound changes that are going to have impacts on humans.
We had a very warm winter in parts of the U.S. last winter, but they had a very cold winter in Europe. How does that factor, all that sort of divergence explain itself here, David?
Right. Well, it was cold for a portion of the winter in Europe, much as it was cold and snowy in 2010 and 2011 winters for about a month in each of those winters in the eastern half of the United States.
Yep.
And this, of course, there's plenty to talk about in terms of natural variability when it comes to these situations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's beginning to be an emerging look, and I won't say an understanding necessarily at this point, that what's happening in the polar regions in the summer and fall may be resulting, as I said earlier, in a more amplified wave pattern to the jet stream and one that moves more sluggishly. So you can get locked into excessive warmth for an extended period of the winter, for instance, or an extended period of cold that could promote some snow in another part of the winter. And these areas are not necessarily going to be in the same place every winter. But of course, there is so much variability in the system, and that's what makes it so difficult to pin down the ultimate cause of everything that's going on. And it opens the door for some perhaps overly critical skeptics to say that it's all natural variability. I wish we could all be very patient. Climatologists by nature have to be somewhat patient, but we can't be overly patient when things are happening at such a rapid pace.
And when you get into issues like rainfall and crops and all the rest, Kate in Mystic, Connecticut. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It seems to me that we're not making much progress on fixing this problem. People aren't going to give up their cars, or they're not going to build better cars fast enough. But there could be a low-tech kind of solution. Couldn't we just build like an artificial ice cap out of sheets of, like, I don't know, white plastic that has the same reflectivity as ice and put that up there, and that would reflect back the sunlight and solve the problem? I mean, it's pretty low-tech. We can send a man to the moon and build a space station. It seems like we should be able to do that. And it also might be a chance for climate control, because we could turn these big white panels on edge. If we felt the winter was too cold, we could turn them on edge and have some control.
Easier to engineer the North Pole than to engineer human behavior. You may be right, Kate. Walt, what about it? Can we just shrink wrap the North Pole in white plastic and get on with it?
Yeah, geoengineering has been talked about quite a bit as a kind of a last gap solution. It makes a lot of people fairly wary about that, because first there's the cost and the technological issues. For example, up in the Arctic, it may seem pretty easy to put a big white sheet up there, but the ice is moving around constantly with the winds and currents, and
sure,
keeping something like that in place would be a challenge. The other thing,
never mind what the polar bear is going to think of that,
right? Along with the effects, the local ecosystem effects, and so as you mentioned, but there's also the concern that geoengineering, do we know enough to do that in a smart way, in a way that won't have side effects, so to speak? We may fix one problem and cause a whole host of other problems. The one thing that we do know was what the behavior of the climate at lower greenhouse gas levels. And so the safest approach is to reduce those and get back to a more stable climate that we've had for the last 10,000 years. It may be that geoengineering becomes necessary, and there's various other, that's one possible explanation, possible solution is changing the reflectivity by making the Earth whiter.
But then we're into a whole new layer of consequences, I'm sure. Nathan in University Heights, Ohio. Nathan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Just looking at the front page of the New York Times gives us an inkling of what's going on. Also, one of the questions I have is, might sound like a cheesy sci-fi movie, but the balance of the Earth, literally, we know that ice is much heavier than water. If that is gone, what will it do with the access of the Earth? And two, where does that water go? All of a sudden, will a lot of our beaches be gone?
Well, that's sea rise, and you're on to that piece of it. David Robinson, what about the simple weight of ice versus water? And, of course, less concentrated if it's water. It can flow anywhere, but I don't know. Will it re-tilt the Earth in some new angle, David?
Right. Well, we're talking the same mass, whether it's in the form of ice or in the form of liquid water. What we would be talking about here is redistributing the mass somewhat,
right,
taking it from the poles and placing it elsewhere. And there certainly would be local ramifications for that. As the ice is removed from the Greenland and Antarctic continents, the land underneath it would rise, and as water coursed over to other areas and the weight of the water sat on top of land, that would help depress the land there. But as far as changing the axial rotation of the Earth, that's beyond my realm, well into geophysics. And it might have some very minute implications, but nothing profound as far as I know.
So we'll just leave that as an interesting open question right there. Gosh, it is hard to know how to take this all on board. I mean, Walt, if you were king of the world, what would you do?
Well, I think I wouldn't be comfortable as being king of the world, I suppose. But,
me either.
But. Yeah, but I think the thing that the way to think about this, oftentimes it gets portrayed as kind of either we have to sacrifice, you know, our lifestyle and go back to the Stone Age, or the planet's going to be devastated. And I think we need to kind of think of it more in terms of, you know, let's agree on the science. You know, let's not obfuscate the science. The science is clearly showing that there is a big change happening, and that there's an effect of that, and that there's going to be a cost. And let's look at the cost. Let's look at what it's going to take, and look at the best way to do it. It's, you know, just like you look at your house, you know, and you get insurance for your house. But let's look at purchasing some insurance for the planet.
And David, maybe not get Stone Age, just get savvy for our own good.
Yeah, we're past the point of saying that we can just mitigate our way from this by reducing greenhouse gases. We have to accept the fact that we're going to need to adapt. I agree completely with all that Walt said about this. We're facing a different world. Let's face it. Let's try to understand it even more and get on with it.
David Robinson, climatologist and professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers University. So good of you to be with us today, David. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Walt Meyer in Boulder, Colorado, research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. Walt, really terrific to have your insights today. Our thanks as well to Julian Struva there. Thank you for joining us, Walt.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Listeners, thanks for all your contributions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.